I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, specialist in hospice and palliative care, and this is Dying to Talk, a new KALW series dedicated to transforming the taboo around death. Why do some people seem to accept death as part of life, while others approach it as more of an option? Does our own upbringing influence our perspective, or is it a reflection of the time and culture we live in? Up next, we'll hear author, professor, and master storyteller Sarah Ladipo Manyika weave her own multicultural background into stories that illuminate this universal human experience. And we'll discover how language, literature, and ritual can inspire us to connect as we contemplate the reality of mortality. Join us and the conversation after this news.
I'm Stuart McIntosh with the BBC News. Hello. The chief whip of South Africa's governing African National Congress, Jackson Ntembo, has urged the entire party leadership, including President Jacob Zuma, to step down. Mr. Ntembo was reacting to the government decision to bring fraud charges against the finance minister, Pravin Gordhan. Rifts within the ANC have widened over the issue. Our Africa correspondent Milton Nkosi reports.
The African National Congress Parliamentary Chief Whip Jackson Mtembu said that the current leadership, including President Jacob Zuma, cannot take the ANC forward. He is calling for the entire executive committee to step down. He said the fraud charges facing Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan are for political reasons. Mr. Mtembu's comments come a week after Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa also publicly expressed support for Minister Gordhan, saying the case against him should not be allowed to undermine his efforts to revive the economy. The governing ANC, which liberated South Africa from white minority rule in 1994, suffered its worst electoral performance in August.
The leadership of the main opposition Socialist Party in Spain has ended 10 months of political deadlock and agreed to allow the Conservative, Mariano Rajoy, to return to power as Prime Minister. The Socialist Governing Council voted to lift the party's parliamentary veto on Mr. Rajoy's proposed minority government. Neither the Socialists nor the Popular Party of Mr. Rajoy have managed to secure a parliamentary majority in the last two elections, and they've failed to negotiate a coalition. Islamic State militants in Iraq have launched an attack on the remote western town of Rutba in what seems to be their latest attempt to divert attention away from the battle for Mosul. The mayor of Rutba in the western province of Anbar said the jihadists had broken into the town and clashed with the security forces. The army commander in the region said IS used five suicide car bombs in the attack, but that order had since been restored. The attack comes as Iraqi government and Kurdish forces in northern Iraq continue their offensive against Mosul, the main IS stronghold in the country. Four of Australia's richest landowners have launched a counterbid to purchase the country's largest cattle farm, potentially keeping the land away from Chinese investors. The $294 million offer is the first all-Australian bid for the cattle firm S. Kidman & Company, topping a joint Australian-Chinese offer lodged 2 weeks ago. Canberra has already rejected two Chinese bids for the land in an effort to protect national interests. The organisers of the 2022 Football World Cup in Qatar have for the first time acknowledged what they call a work-related death at one of the stadiums under construction. They said the worker died on Saturday. The organisers have been criticised for poor safety standards, but they say only three workers have died so far. This is the World News from the BBC. And excuse me, but I don't have the correct scripts for the next story, so I'm going to just pause while I rearrange things. The United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime say the cultivation of the opium poppy in Afghanistan has risen 10% to 2016 to more than 200,000 hectares. Our South Asia editor, Catherine Davis, reports.
Afghanistan is the world's largest producer of opium, the main ingredient in heroin. International donors have spent billions of dollars on counter-narcotics programs there over the past decade. But now the UN is speaking of a worrying reversal in efforts. With high levels of cultivation this year and favourable weather conditions, the harvest is estimated to be 40% bigger than last year's. And, the report says, cultivation is spreading to new areas. It's increased in Afghanistan's northern region, where the security situation has worsened over the past year.
Right, we're back on course now. The EU has given the Belgian region of Wallonia until Monday evening to approve the bloc's free trade deal with Canada. EU sources said if the Walloon administration still insisted on preventing Belgium from signing the agreement, Thursday's planned summit with Canada would be called off. The Italian finance minister, Pier Carlo Padoan, has questioned European Union budget rules, saying Italy needs more flexibility to deal with the refugee crisis and the aftermath of an earthquake. The government financial plans for next year are being examined by the European Commission. Mr. Padoan said Italy had spent billions in recent years addressing the migrant crisis. A new study has found that schools in the northeastern Nigerian state of Borno are still insecure more than 2 years after jihadists abducted more than 200 schoolgirls. The report by two Nigerian women's groups say most state schools don't screen visitors. And that is the BBC News.
Welcome. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, and this is Dying to Talk, a special series on KALW tackling taboos around death and dying. Giving people permission to speak freely about life and death, and what matters most, is at the heart of what I do as a hospice and palliative care physician. And of the many things I've come to appreciate, one thing is abundantly clear. How we die is a reflection of how we live. What is it that makes it possible for some people to look death straight in the eye, even turn toward it and accept mortality, while others seem to be repelled? And how do the words we choose to speak about death influence our ability to accept our own impermanence? In the next hour, we're going to explore how language, time, and culture influence our perspectives on birth, death, and the life in between. Joining me in studio to share both personal and inspired stories is a woman of rare multicultural upbringing. Born in Nigeria and raised for much of her life in Nigeria, as well as Kenya and the UK, and then on to France, Sarah Ladipo Manyika eventually came to the Bay Area to study, becoming an author, professor, and master storyteller. As you'll soon be able to tell, Sarah has also worked with the revered Anna Deavere Smith, and her latest novel, from which she'll read, Like a Mule Bringing Ice Cream to the Sun, explores the experience of a transplanted African woman aging in America. Sarah, welcome to Dying to Talk.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here.
It is really my honor. And you and I have been talking about this conversation in this program for a while now, and recently you shared actually how perhaps the serendipity of the universe or not, this conversation has become really personal. Would you mind sharing?
Yes. I've been thinking about this conversation for a while in, I suppose, somewhat abstract, theoretical ways. And earlier this week, I heard that a friend of mine had died, and this friend was in his 40s. And so suddenly the conversation became very real, very personal. Yeah.
And so inside of that, how do you notice, as you've thought about what we'll be talking about today and what you talk about in your book, which we'll get to, does it change the relationship to death and life?
I think perhaps not so much change as just underline things that I try and hold to. So, you know, I the last long conversation I had with this particular friend was a few months ago, and we hadn't seen each other for a few years, and we talked about how quickly time flies and the brevity of life and how important it is to really seize life and, you know, make the best of our time here. And so there was a particular poignancy recalling that last conversation that we had, and almost a reminder of that conversation to just again underlining how important it is to live life and just embrace it. And that's, you know, certainly something that comes up in my book with my main character.
And have you even seen at home or with friends and family a shift in your attention
to what it means to savor or be present to life or hold to it a little more closely.
Absolutely, yes.
So maybe you can share with us what it was like beginning, growing up in Nigeria, and you've had really close exposure to weaving in life and death intimately.
Yes, I grew up in the north of Nigeria in a place called Jos, and death really was very much part of life. It very much seemed like the natural order of things. I grew up at the time in a place where the infrastructure, the roads were not very good. We lost friends, family to road accidents. We lost friends and family to illness. So, in fact, when I was very young, there was Lassa fever swept through our part of Nigeria, and Lassa fever was very similar in terms of being highly contagious, a deadly hemorrhagic virus, very similar to Ebola. And so, you know, I, as a very young child, I was very conscious of the fact that illness like that can sweep through and cause death. My father is a pastor, and so I also, for most of my childhood, lived close to a church next to a cemetery, and I'd spend a lot of time there. And so in that sense as well, you know, death and the fact of dying was just seemed very natural and normal. And so that was my experience in Nigeria. And then my mother is British, and every 2 years we would visit my grandparents in England. And my grandparents in England had elderly friends, and it seemed as if every time we would visit, someone was dying or had just died. So I think in that sense, my childhood was, when I compare my childhood, say, to the childhood of my child here, my son, very different, in that death really was around us. And it even, you know, in the rituals of life, it was there. Before we would travel, we would say prayers, and even in the language in which we referred to things, you know, saying, you know, God willing, inshallah, not taking life for granted.
Mm. And you've talked about actually some of the rituals and the fact that, as you mentioned, being in very close proximity to a cemetery, that, again, as a child, your friends, your childhood friends that would be familiar with this, it wasn't that it was just you, because your father was a pastor, were in close proximity, that this was a place that you would spend time.
Yes, and you know, just thinking back to the cemetery, for example, I remember there was a family or a series of graves, and it was all one family, and I can't remember how this family had died, but they'd all died at the same time, and they were connected to a family that I knew, so the relatives that were living. And so, you know, in that sense, there was a continuity. It wasn't divorced from the people that I knew who were living. And it's interesting, actually, just thinking about that experience now, I sometimes wonder if my interest in writing and in stories had some of the seeds of that were in that childhood experience, because I would just love to walk around looking at the tombstones, you know, trying to guess how long people had lived and trying to imagine what their lives were like. It wasn't a morbid experience at all. It was actually, again, it just seemed very natural and normal, and I liked to be there. So, yeah.
It's calming. I was just with some dear friends of mine this weekend in Pescadero, a very old cemetery there, and everyone was drawn to just want to walk amongst it and be in that quiet time and space and imagine. And so that creative spark that you're talking about, imagining these lives. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So maybe we can talk about some of these lives that you've been imagining and share with us a bit about your newest novel.
So the novel I've just written is entitled Like a Mule, Bringing Ice Cream to the Sun. A very long title for a very short book. And in fact, the title is borrowed from two lines of a
poem by a poet called Mary Ruffel, a contemporary American poet. And the title of the poem from which the lines are taken is Donkey On. And in this poem, there is a character who is, towards the end of the poem, given an extra year of life. And how does she spend this extra year of life? She spends it like a mule bringing ice cream to the sun. So I felt that this title was quite appropriate to what I was writing about. These lines spoke to me of the bittersweetness of life and, frankly, just how quickly life passes. And so that's how the book came to have its title. And the book is about a woman just about to turn 75, a Nigerian expatriate in America. And it's a story of her life. It's a story of her friends. It's a story of friendship, aging, loss, desire. And my main character is a vivacious, larger than life, older woman. And at a certain point in this book, she has a fall, and that sort of shakes the certainty of, you know, well, it certainly shakes her sense of being fully independent and so forth. And so she really has to think, as we all have to think, of, you know, the end of our lives, and we're all mortal.
So, Sarah, I'm going to ask you to read a section from the book, if you would. This is Sarah Ladipo Manica reading from Like a Mule Bringing Ice Cream to the Sun.
Okay, so this passage comes towards the beginning of the book, and she's thinking about her life in San Francisco. And she's recently just got a letter from the DMV, and it looks like she might have to have another driving test. And this frightens her because it sort of, it's means that she might lose her independence in terms of being able to drive where she wants to if she doesn't get her license. So here it is. You know, I treasure this city with its bright morning sun and brilliant blue skies. I love the way the fog rolls in late in the day, tumbling over Sutro Forest to cloak my part of the city in soft white mist. But you know, it's the people of San Francisco, so often quirky, but always friendly, that makes it feel like home to me. And then I hear a car that roars the way mine does, which reminds me, what will I do if I don't pass the eye test? It's not the first time I fretted over this, but previously, I've always managed to talk myself out of worrying. I turn left now on Parnassus to sit for a moment at the bus stop and catch my breath. I perch on the edge of a red plastic seat, clutching the tulips tightly to my chest, considering my options. Public transportation or a chauffeur? Is that really all there is? And public transport isn't as convenient as it is in London. I've had drivers in the past, but in different contexts, different countries. In San Francisco, a driver is expensive. And anyway, I want to remain independent, to be able to take off whenever I feel like it. It's not a question of getting from A to B, but the freedom to do as I choose.
The freedom to do as I choose. Mm. I think that resonates deeply for so many of us, our entire life, right? She's contemplating it at this juncture that alerts her to the risk. But I wonder, again, given that you wrote this, what have you been reflecting on that has you pay attention to maintaining that right to choose for yourself, for your family?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the reasons that I wrote this book was that I had come from Nigeria where, as I, you know, had said, death seemed to be the natural order of things. And then coming to San Francisco, where the emphasis was so much on insuring one's life. You know, you could get insurance for your house against earthquakes, against fire, against flooding. You know, and one needed to, and that's important. And next to that was this emphasis on youth. Definitely was not a good idea to grow old, despite the fact that that's the direction we're all headed in from the minute we're born. And so those two things, I think, had me thinking about, really thinking about, well, what is it like to age and die in this culture? And what is it like for someone who comes from a different culture to experience that here? And I, you know, again, one of the things growing up in Nigeria, I always had friends of different ages. And that was another bit of a shock for me here, that people tend to sort of stick to their age sets. And I think that's another thing that sort of prepares one for different stages of your life if you're with people from different age sets. And so I here in San Francisco have friends in their 70s and 80s. And I just really wanted to explore that more in terms of writing. And, you know,
You just said in Nigeria it was more, or is more natural to have multi-generational interactions, and yet here that's not what you observed, and yet you've created that. How have you done that? Just
it's quite simple. saying hello to one's neighbors, first of all. and different sort of community groups or, you know, places that one belongs to, there are people of different ages. I think it's not really so hard to break out and have friends from different age sets, but it doesn't feel like that's the norm here.
And have you noticed something distinct about the older friends that you have been able to interact with as compared to those in Nigeria or anywhere else in the world that you've been, for that matter?
Well, I don't want to generalize. I mean, there certainly is perhaps a bit of a surprise here when, you know, maybe younger generations want to hang out with, when I'm with older people, not expecting me to want to spend so much time. I don't know. In some ways, I guess I don't see age. We're all people. We're all just at different points in our lives, different circumstances. So even though I'm describing this as mixing with people of different age sets, I don't actually, when I'm with people, think so much about their age.
Well, I think that speaks to this sense of being present and accepting the whole circle of life and death and the uncertainty of it. Again, that it sounds like you were raised with an intensity as compared to perhaps how I've grown up here in America, where death was in the media and it was sort of at arm's length unless someone in my family died. And even as a child, I'll say, I was not brought to the cemetery. I was protected, so to speak, and I make little quotes with my hands, little Lego quotes there, protected from that experience of someone dying in my family until I was much, much older and actually had to kind of force my way in, saying, no, I want to be present, which sounds quite different from your upbringing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I should also say, though, that the other side of this, living in America, as I do as a black woman, in a black family, there is another side to this. So on the one hand, there is a certain remove. You know, as I said, we try and insure ourselves against death and so forth. And yet, as someone who is black in America right now, one cannot help but think about death. And I think, I think that's important to highlight. One of the writers I've been reading a fair bit of their work recently is Claudia Rankine, who's become quite well known for her latest book, Citizen. And I was reading an essay that she wrote entitled "The Condition of Black Life is One of Mourning." And, I have a teenage black son in this society. And so I think that's something that I cannot avoid. It's something that I think of a lot.
With that, we're going to take a pause. When I come back, we'll have you read some more from your new novel, which I want to mention is up for the Goldsmith Prize. I want to invite our listeners to think about what are the impacts that you've noticed in the different places you've lived, your upbringing, or perhaps your parents' or grandparents' upbringing. How has that influenced how you think about or integrate life and death and who you hang out with? We're going to take a brief break and we'll be back with Sarah Ladipo Manica. This is Dying to Talk.
If you'd like to join the conversation on Dying to Talk, give us a call at 1-866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email Dawn at Dawn, D-A-W-N, at dyingtotalkradio.com. You're listening to Dying to Talk on 91.7 KALW, a special series through the month of October on your local public radio. And now let's go back to Dr. Dawn Gross.
So if you're just joining us, I'm here with author and master storyteller Sarah Ladipo Manica, and we've been talking about her really extensive travel and multicultural upbringing, being raised between multiple continents, Africa, Europe, and now America, and raising your own son here in America, and some of the differences that you have started to notice perhaps your whole life and now in contrast to how other people are growing up and choices that you're making as far as educating yourself, your son, and perhaps the world with your literature now. And I wonder if before we go right to another reading, which I'm very excited to have you share, you want to give us just a little bridge, if you will, of I'm certain that you have shared personal stories with your son and what he's maybe reflected back to you as far as what his experience is now growing up here as a young person.
Yes, I sort of take a pause because that's a much longer conversation. And I've written an essay on this particular topic, growing up in the time of the hoodie. I think that's what it's called.
Yeah, I think that's right.
You know, again, his experience of, you know, we don't live next to a cemetery and right. so forth. So his experience is very different to mine. I don't think he's lost anyone close. But certainly as a young black man in America, in the times in which we live now, you know, he's very careful about the way he dresses. He's very careful about not walking too close to, you know, to women, not to frighten them. Perhaps what I'll do is I'll just read a very short bit from Claudia Rankine's essay, The Condition of Black Life as One of Mourning, that I'd mentioned earlier, because really what she describes in this particular paragraph is what I think I feel and what my son experiences too. So here in the essay she says, "There really is no mode of empathy that can replicate the daily strain of knowing that as a black person you can be killed for simply being black. No hands in your pockets, no playing music, no sudden movements, no driving your car, no walking at night, no walking in the day, no turning into the street, no entering this building, no standing your ground, no standing here, no standing there, no talking back, no playing with toy guns, no living while black."
And while I agree this is a much longer conversation and slightly different than the focus of Dying to Talk per se, I think what we're hearing is while you were raised and have integrated a reality of life and death as intimate, for a very different experience, if you will, of, as you described, the roads were simply not well constructed mm-hmm. at a time you were growing up mm-hmm. in Nigeria. So at the time you were growing up, that's probably different now. If you were raising your son in Nigeria, he would likely have a different experience of that. Right. And yet there is still a growing up culture of death being near. And absolutely. I wonder if that has created an opening for conversation with you and your son and your husband and perhaps your father of how do we, in this context of knowing we're impermanent, in this context of knowing death is near, no matter the cause, and not to say that the cause doesn't matter, it absolutely does. That's not what I'm suggesting here. But given that closeness of alertness, your eyes are open. Do you talk about what matters to you? And God forbid if something happened, none of us want to die today, right? How would you want your family to honor or care for you or remember or share these sorts of things? Do you have those conversations here?
Yes. I mean, we you know, as a matter of life and death, we have to have these conversations as a Black family. But I think what you mentioned just about, you know, being present, we all of us, no matter where we find ourselves or what we find ourselves facing, it's important that we look at life clearly and not just rush through life, but to be present. And to be present means different things for different people, but it's still something that's important for all of us to do. Yeah, I mean, I should, you know, in terms of, you know, on a more upbeat note, I should also say that, you know, I mentioned my father's a pastor, and my father has been such an amazing example for me in many ways, but particularly in terms of thinking about life. My father, I remember when he turned 70, he combined his two great loves, his love of the Bible and his love of football, soccer in American parlance. And he said, you know, now that I've turned 3 score years and 10, the rest is overtime. And, you know, I remember he couldn't wait to get his, you know, old people's person free bus pass or whatever it is, that, whatever it's called in England. I spoke to him earlier this week and he's, you know, will soon turn 80. And he said, you know, he went to his doctor and had his annual checkup, and his doctor had suggested that he do some sort of invasive something next year, just to make sure he, I don't know what it was, but wasn't suffering from something. And my father just very, you know, calmly said, you know, I'm turning 80 and I don't need to do those things. He'll take good care of himself, but he has no desire to, you know, extend his life forever and ever. I mean, obviously my father's a Christian, so he's very eager to go to heaven. But that aside, I think just his approach to I'm not clinging desperately to life is a real example. And as such, I believe my father will outlive us all.
Right.
So
I have certainly seen that in the work I do in my own family. There is this relaxing into this is how I want to live my life. And we don't need to do sort of extraneous measures to try and ensure that my life is longer and longer and longer. Let's just enjoy. So I'm going to ask you if you would read, because I think this next part of your book kind of speaks to that approach to life. I want to remind our listeners that you can join our conversation. And if you are someone who is contemplating how, say, the medical system is friend or perhaps foe, at some point in life becomes more challenging then helpful. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love for you to share our thoughts. And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Sarah Ladipo Manica, please share with us.
So this is my main character, Moriah Da Silva, seizing life. She's contemplating her birthday. And here she is. I have two traditions when it comes to birthdays. The first is to buy shoes. And this year's shoes have a sensible wedge heel with a peekaboo toe. On the outside, they are scarlet red. And because it's a big birthday. I match the shoes with my black chiffon dress and double string of pearls. Pearls that have accompanied me to all manner of places, from lunch with Mrs. Gandhi to tea at Buckingham Palace, to this little place here in San Francisco, where I really must get round to replacing the broken glass in my full-length mirror. I climb onto the ledge of the bath, and I hold firmly to the edge of the door to balance. This way, I can see both the shoes and the dress in the bathroom mirror, and imagine right there, where I place the palm of my hand, the spot for a tattoo. Because this is my second tradition when it comes to doing something new and daring with each passing year. Last year, it was scuba diving, and the year before, learning to swim. Well, I mean, you can't scuba dive without swimming. This year, it's the tattoo, and it's not just the fact of getting a tattoo, but it's where I intend to have it done that thrills me. I've decided that something on the wrist or ankle would be too ordinary. My bakery friend has a Chinese dragon that spreads across her back with its feet perched on her thigh. I have never had the courage for something as big as a dragon, but perhaps I could have a tiny little blossom, symbolic of the tropical climes that I so love. Yes, I'm beginning to think that this is a good idea. What could be more perfect to mark my 75th birthday than this? I twist for a better view, and then, in mid-twist, I slip.
I just get shivers. And I'm not laughing. I mean, it's horrifying, mm-hmm. right? Her life mm-hmm. changes dramatically from this point. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to spoil it. People need to read this book. But I think there's such ability to recognize this is all of us.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, we just never know. And you know, as I've been thinking about this program, I've also been thinking about literature and those who've written about aging and death. And, you know, I've already referenced the fact that the title of my book is taken from a poet. And I think of a well-known poem on death. I don't remember what it's called, but it's an Emily Dickinson poem that begins, "Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me." And, yeah, it's... It's a reality, and we are often just running headlong with our lives, and then things happen.
We have an email here from Virginia who speaks to this, and she writes, "Thank you for the program, Virginia. You're so welcome. Thank you for listening." Virginia says, "I have experienced the death of many loved ones in my life, some of them before I was even 20. I believe that there is a lesson to be learned from the death of others. Why do I get to continue living when other people seem to randomly pass away? I believe that as a person who has been passed over by death, it is incumbent upon me to live a good life, to make every minute count. All of these things we hear and read in the literature that we study, but it is only after experiencing the death of a loved one that this lesson actually came to fruition in my mind. Another concept that is interesting to me about death is how difficult it can be when a person is going to die, but the medical institutions insist on keeping him or her alive while he or she is suffering a great deal. I'm so gratified that new laws have come about to help our society in this area. Thank you." And thank you, Virginia. I think, you know, her email touches on a lot of some of the things you've already said, Sarah, talking about, you know, how we opened our conversation today. This is personal now. This isn't theoretical for you. This came out of nowhere, and suddenly, yeah, mm-hmm. there is no guarantee for any of us. And it doesn't need to be morbid as a result of that. As Virginia suggests, this is then perhaps a reminder to live even more intensely, more present.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So as you carry your character through this fall, you know, there are some points in the book that
that has her intersect with America's healthcare system, which again, as Virginia alludes to, sometimes may not seem to be in keeping with what is happening in life and the absolute reality of death. And I wonder if your character were to have slipped and fallen in, say, Nigeria or in the UK or in Kenya, how might you imagine things changing in the storyline?
Well, you know, again, I don't want to generalize, and I also don't want to idealize, you know, other cultures. I think, you know, one of the reasons one could argue why old age is so revered, say, in a place, or has historically been so revered in Nigeria or even in earlier centuries in any culture, really, is because they're not a lot of old people. So once you get to a situation where, you know, great healthcare and so forth can extend life indefinitely, it's not such a rare thing. As lives are extended, there are more cases of dementia and so forth. So my character traditionally in a Nigerian setting would have lots of family around her and so forth. It wouldn't be such a lonely experience. I think maybe that's the one big difference that would still hold today. Referencing Claudia Rankine, the book before Citizen is entitled Don't Let Me Be Lonely, and there was a particular part in that book where she talks about going to visit a grandmother in an elderly home, and she talks about the people putting out their hands, not for food or water, but for company, for touch, and I think that's somewhere, that's an area that we can do better, you know, globally, but particularly in America or in so-called first world countries, that, you know, it might not necessarily be a question of sort of medical inventions and so forth, but just basic human interventions. Just being there for people, keeping them company.
I think one of the things that has evolved in medical practice is actually a specialty that is focusing on doing what you just described, of having people be close and be present with each other. So hospice and palliative care, my specialty and one I get to share with so many incredibly committed and talented professionals in medicine, in nursing, in social work, and spiritual care, as well as thousands of volunteers that want to be present with people, that truly just want to show up. And if it means holding your hand, or listening to stories, or sharing a morsel of food, something that brings you close to your humanity, to what matters most to you, right, discovering what that is and sharing in that. I think sometimes we, as you've said earlier, we're sort of racing through life, we're pushing through, and we skip it.
Right. And I think, you know, another thing as a writer that I think is very informative about the way that we see life and think about life and think about death is in the language that we use to describe it. So again, thinking about the friend that I lost, the friend's father was quite well known, and so his death has been covered in the papers. And so I've been able to sort of watch how it's been described in the newspapers, but also how we describe it between friends. And it's very striking how in the newspapers will report so-and-so has died. But then as friends, we often use euphemisms. They have passed away. They've gone to rest. He has been taken. And I think, you know, this is something very universal in language. So I've talked to people who speak other languages, and I've been just thinking about this week. I've been very touched by sort of the euphemisms sometimes that we use. So things like, you know, going to rest or going home, those phrases are very present in African languages that I'm familiar with, like Yoruba and Shona. I was talking to someone who speaks Italian, and he said there's a phrase in Italian that it references a candle being blown out. In German, closing the umbrella, and in Russian, stretching out
one's legs. I mean, it's just, I think it would be interesting to see in, you know, with other people in other languages, is there that same way of talking about death and the end of one's life?
Yeah, there are limitless possibilities of how we can comfort ourselves in trying to imagine what's unimaginable. You know, I say to people, to the best of my knowledge, I have not died already, and so can't really speak with any insight, authority, knowledge of what that's like. And as I work in the field with people approaching the end of their life, you know, it is a best guess as to how to support people in this transition. And yet, the people that are very much alive, bearing witness, present, it's very clear how things are going there and how to support people then by allowing us to express what we're experiencing in whatever words. And sometimes words fail us.
Absolutely.
Even the euphemisms can't touch. Mm-hmm. And so silence, music, art, and then turning toward other people's words, perhaps literature, poetry, to help us navigate this previously really unfathomable experience that then stays with us for the rest of our lives.
Right. Yeah.
So I wonder if maybe you can share, or if we can have you pick up a last piece from your novel, but how your character and really the community she creates around her. I remember a distinct part in the book that really resonated with me, and that she goes to an assisted living facility and how people become connected that are not family, you know, blood related or what have you, but start to weave in relationships in ways that are maybe invisible to those of us who don't necessarily work in those worlds or interact or have people in our lives in those settings. And you bring them to life in such a magnificent way. And I wonder where your experience came from or where your insight into that came from.
Well, I think, you know, again, I feel like I need to say that as a, you know, I have limited insight. And as a writer, what we often do is we try and put ourselves in other people, or what we try and do is we put ourselves in other people's shoes as fiction writers, and we try and imagine. I think, you know, I have older friends. And as I was writing this book, I had one particular friend who used to be a neighbor in her 80s who had Parkinson's disease and Parkinson's related dementia. And so as she moved from one caring facility to another, I would visit her, and it was a difficult time, and it was difficult watching her lose her faculties, her memories, and being very conscious of that. And at the same time, though, I would also notice those around her, those who were carers, the nurses, the assistants, and how for this particular friend who didn't have any immediate family, those carers became so close so quickly. And just that human bonding that we have, and how important those people are at the end of life. So I think, you know, if I have any insight, it's a combination as a fiction writer of imagination, perhaps wishful thinking, and just having spent time with older friends.
Well, I think your imagination is spot on, and it really does beautiful justice to people that commit their lives to caring for people that begin as strangers, as we all do, but really take them under their wing. We have an email here from Holly. She's wanting to know, Sarah, and maybe you can address this, how would the concept of, and she puts in quote, helping someone to die, be looked at in Nigeria? There's so much controversy about that here in the U.S., and she's wondering, Holly's wondering, how it's seen or even legislated in Nigeria. Do you know?
I should say that I haven't lived in Nigeria for 2 decades now, so I have no idea about how it's legislated. I also, you know, I'd like to ask Holly, but I can't. You know,
what she means, or she can call us.
What she means by helping people to die. I mean, I think that can be sort of euphemistic as well.
Yes.
I think what I would say is that one of the things, and probably you can address this much better than I can, but one of the things you find in places where there's such advanced healthcare is that you can extend life indefinitely, put people on machines and so forth, and it's not a great quality of life. You know, the silver lining of not having such sophisticated healthcare systems, technology in many parts of Nigeria still today is that you just literally can't extend the life with machines and so forth. So in that respect, you know, I think these questions maybe don't arise as frequently as they do here in the United States. And I think, you know, just referencing authors, Atul Gawande in his book Being Mortal really talks about that. And, you know, his example of the way his great-grandfather died in the Indian context versus, you know, the way that lives can be extended really under not great conditions, just not great quality of life, is something I think we really wrestle with much more in this society than in others at the moment.
And I think both Virginia and Holly's emails were pointing to, and so it's an interpretation of their comments, and so forgive me or please write or call us if I'm wrong, but in speaking about how we've come to address suffering at the end of life and potentially creating laws and legislation, certainly here in California, the recent law of what's called the End of Life Option Act, where people can actually, if they qualify, if they already have a medical illness that's going to predict that they would die naturally in about 6 months, then can avail themselves, if a doctor is willing to write a prescription that is intended to end their life. That's very different from euthanasia, which is available in some countries, not anywhere in the United States, where that's a physician actually injecting a medication to end someone's life. I don't know that that's available anywhere in Africa. I'm not aware of that, but
I don't know. Yeah.
But I've heard of other people's experiences in this regard. And, you know, even our governor in his statement in signing the law was whether he, from a personal religious standpoint, could support it, but on a personal human point, saying there's something comforting about knowing if I needed it, it was there. And I think that's sort of what we're hearing, is if we find ourselves in a situation now that medicine has been able to turn some illnesses into chronic illnesses, and we become then susceptible to other illnesses that we otherwise would never have experienced, like dementia, because we were dying before we got so old, that the manner of what we're comfortable with in a quality of life is changing, and how do we adapt and cope as a society and support it? And we come back to our family and caregivers and community embracing all of that.
Right.
And when you then get transplanted from one culture to another, how do you reinvent that, or do you create it in your own personal family culture? And and what's, I don't know, the opportunity to learn other rituals, other approaches? What have you been able to share here with other people that are born in America and have not seen all the parts of the world that you have seen?
Well, I think I said earlier that, you know, growing up in Nigeria, there were sort of various rituals of life in a way, you know, not taking life for granted, praying before you traveled and so forth. On the flip side, there was also much more emphasis on celebration. Just, again, being cognizant of how brief life can be, how important it is to celebrate. So I think I like to think that what I bring, or some small thing that I bring, is just trying to pause more often in life. And again, pause that sort of headlong rush to do so many things and not just to take stock and to celebrate. What, you know, can be celebrating very tiny things. But that also comes from a spirit of realizing that we're not here for long, and we need to take time just to celebrate and enjoy being with our friends, enjoy those things that make us happy and bring us joy.
And so one more thought before I want you to share maybe one thing that you do to celebrate. As a professor, you know, what is it you hope to impart in those that you get to teach and influence in this conversation? Is it around celebration, or what is it? What do you want people to take home?
I think it is around celebration. I mean, in my classes, yes, that's a very big element, even just sort of pedagogically, not just focusing on your end grade, but enjoying the ride and enjoying, you know, if you're writing as a writer, we have to revise and edit and go through various drafts and pull things apart and put things together, and unexpected things will turn up and throw things off, and the path is not straight. The path is not straight as a writer. It is not straight as it's not straight in life. So yeah, I think that's something that I try and emphasize as a teacher.
Yeah, life happened.
It does.
And what are we going to do with it when we're here?
Yes, we do the best that we can, and we embrace it.
We embrace it. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
My guest this hour has been author, professor, and master storyteller Sarah Ladipo Manyika. Thank you so much for sharing both your voice, your words, your personal stories, and your incredible imagination.
Thank you.
And thanks to our listeners. Thank you for those who emailed us during today's program. It's your curiosity and courage to join our conversation that makes it possible for each of us to consider what matters most in life. Dying to Talk is produced at the studios in KALW in San Francisco. Barbara McVeigh is the in-studio producer, and Eric Wayne is at the controls. Matt Martin is the advising producer, and Ashley Ann Krigbaum and Joanne Marr help create the promos. All of the music for Dying to Talk is by the Oakland-based band The Kilbanes. If you can't wait to share what you just heard or want to learn more about Sarah's writings, all the information and resources from this program, along with today's conversation, will be available on the Dying to Talk page at kalw.org. And if you'd like to join our live audience taping of Dying to Talk on October 29th, registration is open. You can RSVP also on the Dying to Talk page at kalw.org. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, inviting you to be curious, ask questions, and never settle. Or, as a hospice patient once taught me, life is uncertain. Better eat dessert first. I know one of the things you love to do, Sarah, is make homemade apples and berry fruit crisp. Ready for some?